my love finger oh so bad. You're not the only one I've ever had. And if I say I wanna set you free, don't you know you'll be in misery? They call me, they call me Dr. Love. I've got the cure you're thinking of.
All right, that's it for me tonight, folks. Thanks for tuning in. This has been Joe's Garage featuring Emily on 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. Hope you're having a great start to your week, and well, hope I catch you next week here. But we got one more song to round off the show, and it's a song, well, yeah, Emily, you picked out here.
I did, and thanks for having me, you Joe. Thank you. It's been a gas. So the next song I have for you is by a gentleman named Frank Watkinson. And he's doing a cover of Melancholy Hill, but from my understanding and from my little bit of research, during the pandemic, he's an older gentleman, he's like in his 70s, and during the pandemic, he started just covering a bunch of songs, and a vast majority of them are from like the early 2000s, so it's pretty fun to kind of hear that, and he's a YouTube channel too under his name, so. It is Frank Watkinson, Frank, F-R-A-N-K. Watkinson, W-A-T-K-I-N-S-O-N.
You've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Ebony Spectrum and In Black America for this week.
There's concern about a racial wealth gap.
The racial wealth gap is stark.
The racial wealth gap is tremendous.
The gap between white and black America.
What is the racial wealth gap and why is everyone talking about it? The racial wealth gap is a measure of wealth inequality between racial groups in the U.S. Here's a prime example. Black families make up 14% of the population, but own only 5% of American wealth, while white households make up 65% of the population, but control 80% of the wealth. The gap traces back to the 1863 Emancipation Proclamation, which led to freedom for almost 4 million Black Americans. By 1860, their labor accounted for 60% of U.S. exports, $200 million a year, but Black Americans received nothing, no land, no money. Without any money or land, how could newly free Black Americans create wealth? One way could have been the banking system. Alexander Hamilton, the father of American banking, said that banking is how wealth is created. But Black Americans were overwhelmingly excluded from using banks. So what happens when a community is barred from the mainstream banking system? They create their own. Black banks are supposed to close the racial wealth gap. So what happened? For almost 200 years, there have been three unique barriers that have kept Black America from generating the wealth the Black community intended: discriminatory lending, housing discrimination, and economic segregation. First, let's talk about discriminatory lending. Following the Civil War in the late 1800s, Black Americans had few freedoms or financial options due to legal segregation and Black codes. Black codes were laws that restricted the freedom and movement of Black people and forced them to work for low wages. If you were Black, a white bank would either bar you from entering, deny your loan, or charge you higher interest rates. These were common practices of discriminatory lending, and it created a need for financial services that Black-owned banks would aim to provide.
Black communities found ways to create mutual aid opportunities, credit unions, and cooperative efforts to make sure that as they were locked out from mainstream financial institutions, they had the systems in place to make sure that their financial needs were met.
In 1890, one of the earliest Black banks was operating in especially hostile territory, the Jim Crow South. Alabama's first Black-owned and Black-operated bank, the Alabama Penny Savings Bank, was founded by Reverend William Pettiford. Influenced by Booker T. Washington's principles of self-help and racial solidarity, the Alabama Penny Savings Bank lent money to churches and professionals in Birmingham when other banks wouldn't. And it did this during a time when the Alabama legislature was doing everything in its power to deny Black political and economic freedom. Pettiford partnered with powerful white bankers in Birmingham who helped with administrative and staff training. These partnerships were like cheat codes during a time when segregation laws made Black and white relations very difficult. In 1913, the Penny Savings Bank constructed a five-story building that housed not only the bank, but dozens of other Black businesses. The rent from those businesses provided funding and investment capital, something Black banks serving poor communities struggled to get. The Alabama Penny Savings Bank faced financial risks unique to Black banks. A lack of capital or money to invest put Black banks in a risky position. Not only did segregation laws shrink the number of potential customers, low-income customers made smaller deposits and more withdrawals. This meant, one, operation costs were higher, so Black bank owners invested more of their own money to keep the bank stable. And two, it restricted their revenue and lending capacity. Fewer loans meant smaller profits. Pettiford's partnerships with larger banks meant he had aid during difficult times, and the bank grew significantly under his guidance. assets reached over $540,000 by 1913, equivalent to approximately $17.1 million today. By 1914, the Alabama Penny Savings Bank was the largest and strongest black bank in the United States. But no one could be convinced to help the bank after his death. The bank failed just 1 year later, causing depositors to lose all their money. While the Alabama Penny Savings Bank provided an alternative to discriminatory lending, Jim Crow segregation made long-term economic advancement nearly impossible. The second barrier to building wealth, housing discrimination.
One significant driver to the racial wealth gap, as I mentioned before, is going to be homeownership. Homeownership is a significant driver of wealth, whereby every year of homeownership, homeowners gain about $14,000 in equity. Conversely, if you don't have access to homeownership, you don't have access to that type of equity and that cushion that you could get from having money saved from homeownership.
Housing discrimination allows banks to deny home loans to the black community through a practice called redlining. Redlining was a government-sponsored practice of denying mortgages and other financial services to segregated black and brown neighborhoods. It's called redlining because bankers literally drew red lines around undesirable communities. One black household in a middle-class community was enough to make the federal government deny mortgage loans in that area. As a result, black families turned to predatory lenders or were shut out from home ownership completely.
We just keep having to fight battles. But a lot of the things that have happened to black folks in America were orchestrated and they were legal. That was systemic. I mean, it wasn't like it just happened that way. It was designed to be that way.
Black banks made it their mission to fight against these policies. Maggie L. Walker was America's first black female bank founder. Not only did she organize a black bank in the segregated South in 1903, but she managed to run a successful one in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy. It was called St. Luke Penny Savings Bank. As a businesswoman and banker, Walker advocated for black women's financial independence and the advancement of the black community. She famously said,
"Let us put our monies together. Let us have a bank that will take the nickels and turn them into dollars."
By 1920, Walker's bank had provided more than 600 mortgages to black families. It also created jobs for black professionals, allowing them to leave the lower paying jobs. But just because a black family received a home loan didn't mean the challenges stopped there. In 1925, Dr. Ossian Sweet and his wife Gladys bought a home on the edge of Detroit's Black Bottom slums for $6,000 more than its market value. But after moving in, a white mob surrounded their home for several days. They wanted them out. This story is common. The fear that a black family moving near a white neighborhood would tip property values and send the neighborhood into decline was so great that some white homeowners were willing to resort to violence. Once the mob started to damage his property, Sweet fought back and violence broke out. A white man was shot. Sweet was later charged and then, surprisingly, acquitted of murder, but the fear of decline is a self-fulfilling prophecy. When the white upper and middle class leave a community, property values plummet. Businesses and bankers stop investing and neighborhoods are left underfunded. Walker's bank continued to provide loans even when it wasn't commercially profitable. St. Luke served its community for 100 years until just before the 2008 financial crisis. Housing discrimination has continued to make black home ownership unattainable for many, widening the wealth gap. The third barrier is the result of decades of lending and housing discrimination, economic segregation. Economic segregation is the geographical separation of communities based on race and wealth. While redlining has now been illegal for over 50 years, you can still see its effects in the form of economic segregation. If you look at a map of a major U.S. city, you'll see pockets of wealth alongside pockets of poverty in historically segregated communities. And many of the predominantly Black and Brown neighborhoods are low income with unequal access to education, healthcare, and upward mobility.
You're seeing communities that don't have wealth as a function of slavery, as a function of Jim Crow, Black codes, mass incarceration, redlining, entering to a different system of financial services and products. And so the wealth that they should have, they don't have, and the wealth that they could have, they will never have because they're dealing with institutions that are preying upon the poverty.
Pockets of deep poverty are typically the areas Black banks serve, but they struggle to turn a profit and create wealth in their underfunded communities. So what would happen if a low-income community was able to support its businesses and entrepreneurs and keep money flowing within that community? Well, we actually know what that would look like. In the 1900s, during the height of segregation, three notable pockets of Black wealth existed. One was in Durham, North Carolina. During this time, Durham was home to more Black millionaires than any other city in America. Durham's Haytime neighborhood and its Black financial district created a self-sustaining Black Wall Street and was a safe haven from Jim Crow America. Black-owned businesses and wealthy white partners invested in Black innovation, talent, and enabled the flow of capital in the community. During a time where there are few options for Black businesses to secure capital, Mechanics and Farmers Bank was the only financial support for small borrowers like farmers and laborers in Durham. M&F and Durham's Black Wall Street managed to keep the Black dollar circulating within its community for decades and created a thriving Black middle class. But most Black banks struggle to do this, and it's why economic segregation has continued to be a barrier. Unless every buyer and seller deposits their money into a Black bank, eventually the Black dollar will flow into and grow the mainstream economy, leaving the Black community with scraps. The catch-22 of Black banking is that the very institutions needed to help communities escape the deep poverty caused by discrimination and segregation inevitably became victims of that same poverty. In 1958, North Carolina cut a freeway through the heart of Haiti, and Durham's Black Wall Street, along with hundreds of homes and businesses, were destroyed. An M&F bank couldn't withstand the decades-long decline in Black banking without change. In 2015, the organization decided to diversify its customer base and market outside the Black community. Out of the 5,400 FDIC-insured financial institutions, only 23 are Black-owned as of 2018. If you're Black and you walk into a bank today, there's a chance you could be arrested for trying to withdraw money from your own account, denied a mortgage even if you have good credit, or issued predatory loans with high interest rates. The truth is, Black-owned banks face many of the same challenges today as they did 200 years ago, but they're not giving up the fight for financial justice. Modern movements like Bank Black, championed by celebrities like rapper Killer Mike, are revitalizing the push for economic empowerment. Killer Mike and Andrew Young Jr. and others co-founded a financial tech company that recently secured a $45 million investment to encourage banking within the Black community and build Black wealth. An NBA team and the NFL made history when they chose Black banks for loans as high as $35 million. And One United Bank, the nation's largest and first Black-owned digital bank, is fighting for the 49% of Black households who are unbanked or underbanked, providing loans and financial literacy to low-income communities. Addressing these ongoing issues is crucial to creating a more equitable and inclusive financial system. So if Black banks alone aren't going to help close the gap, what could? Initiatives like student loan debt forgiveness, which disproportionately affect Black and Brown graduates, and expanding affordable housing programs and other forms of reparations could help close the gap.
And reparation doesn't have to be a boogeyman concept. It's not all about cash. It's about access. Access is a form of reparations, right?
Black banks may not be able to completely solve the racial wealth gap, but they are one important piece of the puzzle in growing Black wealth in America.
Let's get you into a home. Let's get you into that business. Let's get you into a bank account. And let's get you started on this journey of economic mobility so this generation and the next can say, I'm no longer a victim of these mainstream policies and products. We're on our way toward freedom.
It is not well known, but about 4.5% of U.S. households are unbanked, meaning no one in the house has a checking or a savings account. The rate declined during the pandemic, in part because people opened accounts to receive government stimulus funds. But disparities between the banked and the unbanked persist. Our economics correspondent, Paul Solomon, has a story.
Lord, we praise you and thank you for this food.
At home with his wife in South Memphis, Donald Jenkins.
Amen.
Amen.
So grateful he no longer lives on the edge. For years, a drug addict who couldn't hold a job, his petty cash kept close to the vest.
I had my money in my pocket.
But isn't it dangerous to have it in your pocket?
Yes, yes, very. That's a very dangerous spot to have. We got robbed a few times.
Warehouse clerk Paula Jones used to stash her cash in a can.
We was taught, like, you know, you keep your money at home. It was like, don't deal with banks.
Jones was unbanked. No bank account, as are 6 million U.S. households. Black households unbanked at more than 5 times the rate of white ones.
There's been a distrust of financial institutions since down through history.
Credit counselor Charlestine Harris works at Southern Bancorp in predominantly black Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Because of redlining and the different discrimination policies that were happening in the banking industry at that time, there were not a lot of opportunities to really engage with a financial institution.
Redlining, designated neighborhoods highlighted on maps in red as too hazardous for mortgage lending as far back as early last century, most of them black, stoking distrust still evident in Memphis, where 45% of black residents remain un- or underbanked.
We try to, like, apply for different things, always getting turned down due to, like, bank accounts, credit scores, all these. But then you have somebody that can come up and just, probably in the same situation, they can just walk in and get a house.
Donald Jenkins balked at even entering a bank.
You know, I just couldn't trust nobody, you know. And then the racial thing, you know.
Because these are they're white people at the bank.
Yeah, mostly, you know, when you go in. But they switching it around now. It's different now.
Even so, says Steve Nash of nonprofit Advance Memphis, the anxiety lingers.
Redlining, I think, has been a big, big impact on the community as far as trust with the bank. And it's wealth stripping. When, you know, an institution says, no, we're not going to service you, that's a big deal. That today we're still having to unpack and put back together.
In Mississippi, where the unbanked rate is 11%, the highest in the country, credit counselor Harris says there are other reasons people don't have bank accounts.
The larger banks like U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo and those types of banks are actually leaving the smaller communities. And in the case in the Delta, you really don't have banking opportunities. They've closed down.
When unprofitable bank branches closed in a number of rural communities, Southern Bancorp, a community development financial institution, or CDFI, became the only option.
We're more mission-driven than we are profit-driven.
But even where communities do have a bank, barriers persist.
I wasn't making enough money to deal with a bank.
Clarksdale resident Elizabeth Johnson recently opened an account at Southern. More than a third of the unbanked say they don't have enough money to meet minimum balance requirements. Johnson had been among them, was paid by her employer on a reloadable debit card.
If you're getting your check on the call, what you going to deal with the bank for? I mean, you just want your check.
Like many here.
If you get a Social Security check, something like that, they go to the liquor store or to the pharmacy store and they have to cash their check.
Here's your credit report.
But Johnson came to Southern for credit counseling.
Sometimes it can be a long journey, and so it's not an overnight fix.
Johnson wants to improve her credit so she can buy a little land.
I raised in the country, and I just want to go back. I want to go back and live the rest of my life in the country.
Bad credit or no credit history at all stymies bank loans, makes the poor even poorer as they resort to exorbitant options.
A title lender here, payday advance, place there.
In Memphis, they abound.
You have another there?
Tennessee title loans, yeah.
Reverend J. Lawrence Turner, driving me on Memphis's Get Well Road.
This community just happens to be not only economically disadvantaged, but heavily populated with people who are black and brown.
So everywhere you look, lenders charging interest rates or fees that annualized can run to 300 or 400%.
They're literally twice the number of these financial institutions as they are fast food restaurants.
There's a certain irony in that we're driving on Get Well Road, right?
Yeah, you're not going to get well financially.
Turner has seen so many parishioners caught in a debt trap. His Black Clergy Collaborative partnered with Hope Credit Union, a CDFI, to offer small loans at relatively low cost.
Up to $1,000. Half of that amount is given immediately. The other half is placed in a savings account. Once they have repaid it, the other $500 becomes available to them. As clergy, we help to raise funds in the case that there is a default.
And charge interest at a fraction of what payday lenders do, says Hope CEO Bill Bynum.
You're typically going to pay, in the 10 to 18% range.
That will sound high to a lot of people in our audience.
No, I think if you look at what people pay for short-term, small-dollar loans, most people will pay from 10 to 18%. Think of it as a credit card. And so rather than being in a position where you have to go to a check casher or a payday lender or a pawn shop that's going to charge you 200, 300, 400%, we're charging much less.
Bynum believes this can also be a first step to closing the wealth gap in communities without access to traditional banks.
It's not just a solution to an immediate need. It gives them a ladder that they can climb when they have other needs. You've got the full suite of tools that a traditional bank offers to their customers in more affluent communities.
In its work to promote economic stability, Steve Nash's Advance Memphis provides a material incentive to open a savings account,
where every dollar you save from earned income will match it 2-to-1 to purchase an asset. You can use it to purchase a car, you can use it as a down payment on a house, and then you can use it for post-secondary education.
With the nonprofit's help, Donald Jenkins saved enough to buy a truck, then a house.
Oh man, I got a credit card. It got my name on it. You know, I can get my money off here when I want to.
Jenkins now has his own lawn care business.
So you're really proud that you have a bank account?
Oh, yes, sir.
Proud and finally banked. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman in Memphis, Tennessee.
Next up, we have two interviews with Ta-Nehisi Coates, one with CBS Morning from about a week ago, and the other one with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. So listen to both of them and tell me what you think later on. Take care.
Our next guest is the acclaimed New York Times best-selling author Ta-Nehisi Coates. His new book, The Message, is a trio of interconnected essays that examine how the stories we tell or avoid telling can shape and even distort our reality. In the book, Coates reflects on his emotional first trip to Africa to visit Dakar Senegal. Then he takes readers to Columbia, South Carolina, where he reports on the attempted banning of one of his books on race. And finally, Coates travels to the Middle East to witness the Israeli-Palestinian conflict firsthand. Ta-Nehisi Coates, good morning. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. Good morning, guys.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. You say that this book is written specifically for writers, stating that the task for young writers should be nothing less than changing the world. Why do you feel like writers should bear that responsibility?
Saving the world. Saving the world. Just to be really specific, writing is how we interpret so much of everything that is around us. The Message is a political book. It argues that much of our politics actually happens before we walk into a voting booth, that our choices around us, that who we believe is human, who we don't believe is human, what policies we believe should be in the world, which policies we don't, are actually shaped largely by writing and the stories we tell. And so I believe that writers, and particularly young writers, have so much to do in the politics and in this time when, you know, obviously we have so much conflict and there's so many quote-unquote issues to be dealt with.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. And I have to say, when I read the book,
I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist.
Mm.
And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Mm. Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it?
Mm.
Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel in any condition has a right to exist?
Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media. That's the first thing I would say. I am most concerned always with those who don't have a voice, with those who don't have the ability to talk. I have asked repeatedly in my interviews whether there is a single network, mainstream organization in America with a Palestinian American bureau chief or correspondent who actually has a voice to articulate their part of the world. I've been a reporter for 20 years. The reporters of those who believe more sympathetically about Israel and its right to exist don't have a problem getting their voice out. But what I saw in Palestine, what I saw on the West Bank, what I saw in Haifa in Israel, what I saw in the South Hebron Hills, those were the stories that I have not heard. And those were the stories that I was most occupied with. I wrote a 260-page book. It is not a treatise on the entirety of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
But if you were to read this book, you would be left wondering, why does any of Israel exist? What a horrific place, committing horrific acts on a daily basis. So I think the question is central and key. If Israel has a right to exist, and if your answer is no, then I guess the question becomes, why do the Palestinians have a right to exist?
Answer,
why do 20 different Muslim countries
have
a right
to exist? My answer is that no country in this world establishes its ability to exist through rights. Countries establish their ability to exist through force. As America did. And so I think this question of right to Israel does exist. It's a fact. The question of its right is not a question that I would be faced with any other country.
But you write a book that delegitimizes the pillars of Israel. It seems like an effort to topple the whole building of it. So I come back to the question, and it's what I struggled with throughout this book. What is it that so particularly offends you about the existence of a Jewish state that is a Jewish safe place and not any of the other states out there?
There's nothing that offends me about a Jewish state. I am offended by the idea of states built on ethnocracy, no matter where they are.
Muslim included.
I would not want a state where any group of people laid down their citizenship rights based on ethnicity. The country of Israel is a state in which half the population exists on one tier of citizenship, and everybody else that's ruled by Israelis exists on another tier, including Palestinian Israeli citizens. The only people that exist on that first tier are Israeli Jews. Why do we support that? Why is that okay? I'm the child of Jim Crow. I'm the child of people that were born into a country where that was exactly the case of American apartheid. I walk over there and I walk through the occupied territories and I walk down a street in Hebron. And a guy says to me, I can't walk down the street unless I profess my religion. I'm with another path. No. This is very, very important.
It is.
Extremely important.
Yeah. Let me lay it down.
I'm working with the person that is guiding me is a Palestinian whose father, whose grandfather and grandmother was born in this town. And I have more freedom to walk than he does. He can't ride on certain roads. He can't get water in the same way that Israeli citizens who live less than a mile away from him can.
And why is that?
Why is that okay?
Why is that? Why is there no agency in this book for the Palestinians? They exist in your narrative merely as victims of the Israelis, as though they were not offered peace at any juncture, as though they don't have a stake in this as well. What is their role in the lack of a Palestinian?
I have a very, 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 very moral compass about this. And again, perhaps it's because of my ancestry. Either apartheid is right or it's wrong. It's really, really simple. Either what I saw was right or it's wrong. I am, for instance, against the death penalty. What the person did to get the death penalty, it really doesn't matter to me. I don't care if they were selling a nickel bag of marijuana or if they were a serial killer. I am against the death penalty.
Mm.
I am against a state that discriminates against people on the basis of ethnicity. I'm against that. There is nothing the Palestinians could do
that would make that okay for me. My book is not based on the hyper-morality of the Palestinian people.
In lessons, because many people feel it's complicated. You say it's not complicated. Less than 20 seconds. What's your message?
Less than 20 seconds. I want people to read the book. Well, yeah. And I don't make the assumption that somebody would just read the book and have written and have read nothing else about Israel
okay.
and Palestine.
You're still invited to High Holidays. I'll see you at the show. I mean it, buddy.
That'll do it for us.
Thank you.
Out of time. The message goes on sale tomorrow.
My friend, you are grappling. This is a book of grappling.
It is.
It's reparations, the purpose of art, the purpose of writing, your role, your responsibility, the Israel, Palestine. I can see you don't want to go back to just writing comic books again for 5 years. This is what was in you that you thought, I need to take on these big questions, including what is this for? What is writing for?
I have for a long time had in the back of my head that we do not have a complete understanding of politics. That is to say, we think of politics as what happens inside of a voting booth. You go in and you choose, you know, pull a lever for whatever.
Right.
But there's a whole entire architecture that happens outside of that voting booth that defines what goes on inside of it, what issues are appropriate, frankly, who is human and who is not. And that is the work of stories, movies, television shows, writing, all of that. And being a writer, and this coming out of, you know, me talking to my students at Howard University at the time, I really, really wanted to address that. You know, so often I get the question, why should I write?
Like, why should I write?
No, in general, but by the time they get to me, they usually, my students are like there. But a lot of, you know, other times when I'm, you know, out in the world, what is writing gonna do? Like, what is it actually gonna change? And what I wanted people to understand is writing actually shapes the world around you entirely.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I would have said basic cable, but okay, writing.
But somebody has to write the scripts, right?
That's exactly right. Is that, do you grapple with that as a burden or a call to arms? What is, for you, how do you wear it?
Oh, it's exciting.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it gets me up in the morning.
Right.
It like pumps my blood. Like I can't wait. You know what I mean? Like there are people who, I got a friend who's an ER doc, right? And I was texting this morning about, you know, everything that was going on.
Right.
And he disappeared for a second. He said, sorry, this guy just got shot. I'm sorry. And I said to him, how beautiful is it to have work that actually matters? Are you out there saving people's lives? And I'm not an ER doctor, but it is a blessing to feel like what I write actually matters in the world.
Right.
You know what I mean? It gives me meaning and purpose. And I kind of wanted to convey that, you know, to all the young writers, you know, who hopefully...
As inspiration.
Yes. It's a beautiful thing.
Your friend was at work when the guy got shot,
right? Yes, he was.
Because for a second, I was like, wait, he was at work, right?
Yeah, he was. He was at work.
It wasn't like you were talking to me.
No. He was at work. Yeah.
All right. That's very good. Yeah. Do you get frustrated, and this is something that I think about sometimes, that the world that you would prefer to see, that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice and the work of writing is trying to help facilitate that arc of moral justice is so resilient against bending, that it's so hard to matter in that form.
I get sad.
Right.
And there are a lot of moments in here where I was really sad.
Right.
You know, but at the same time, it fills me with purpose. I don't know if I would have that purpose I talked about just a few minutes ago, you know, without that great difficulty. Honestly, it feels great to know that if I actually try really, really hard at the thing, if I actually work really, really hard to write the best book I possibly can, you know, that I could be here talking to you. That it actually
really you could have written
a
shitty book and been on here. Listen, if that's the case, I can tell you that you didn't have to work nearly this hard. But it is. It's a beautifully felt book. I want to ask you, there's a certain aspect of your career that has really tried to reconcile not with things in the present, but their vestiges, the structures, racial politics, right, slavery, economic injustices, where it might not be the active virus, but it's these vestiges of it that still, you know, leach into the groundwater, right, and make it toxic and polluted. This book felt a little different in that you were also going into the present.
Yeah.
And bringing those lessons with you. And I thought that was a really moving part of the book.
Yeah, that's true, and I guess I'm going to be the one to broach this, but it was obviously most active when I was in Jerusalem, when I was in Haifa, when I was on the West Bank.
Right.
I mean, it was the history, but the history was active.
Right.
And that was tough. I'm used to, you know, going to some, you know, slave plantation and saying, well, yeah, this did happen 150 years ago, but here's how, you know, you can still feel the impact. And you go, no, it's right now.
Right.
It's right now.
And it comes on the heels of, so in the book, you take a trip to Senegal.
I do, yes.
Is that in relation to your trip to Israel and the West Bank in that same time frame, or was that split up?
So I think I went in, this would have been like September of 2022 to Senegal, and then May of 23 to the West Bank and to Israel. And weirdly enough, they are in conversation with each other. I can't say I intended that.
Right. Well, but that's why I was curious, because there is a music there between the two.
Yeah. No, there is. I mean, Senegal is very much about me, frankly, investigating the very stories that gave me my name, you know, and gave me my identity, and trying to work through that, and frankly, not completely working through it by the time I got over there. And then, you know, I take this trip, you know, with this wonderful organization, a Palestine Festival of Literature. And I get over there, you know, for 5 days, and I spent another 5 days with these ex-IDF guys, you know what I mean, who had their own political evolution. And this is very weird to say, but as much sympathy as I had for the Palestinians, watching Zionism in the world, even feeling like this is wrong, what I'm saying is wrong, I was like, my God, I know how you get here. I know how it happens. And I don't mean like I approve of it, but I mean like I see how it happens. I totally see how it happens.
Is how you see how it happens, because you talk about Yad Vashem, mm-hmm. and going there and being moved, is the idea, because you have a line in the book that I think is one of the most powerful, which is, and I want to make sure that I get it right, which is, your oppression will not save you.
Yeah.
Ugh. Which is... And you write about that in relation to the black experience, mm-hmm. in America, but also about the Jewish experience in the Holocaust, as well as in Israel. And, yeah. And what did you mean by that?
I think we would like to think that you go through, you know, a horrific experience, be it the Middle Passage, Jim Crow here, be it the Holocaust or the centuries before that of pogroms, oppression, et cetera. And somehow you will be morally improved by coming out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You might be. But it's just as likely that you will conclude that, in fact, the world is a cold, hard place, and it's a zero-sum game, you know what I mean? And what matters is who has the guns and who doesn't.
Right.
You know? I stand opposed to that, just on principle, period. You know what I mean? But I get how people take that lesson.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think it's discomforting for us to feel, because we feel sympathy for people. You know what I mean?
Of course.
You know, I'm walking through Yad Vashem and I'm feeling it on a very, very deep level, only to come back here and realize I was, you know, about a mile away from a massacre of a Palestinian village. That's hard to take.
Like, hey, it's...
You know what I mean?
Listen, like, I'm raised in, obviously, cultural Jewish tradition, and I imagine, you know, if you were to feel like people in the name of your people did some things that you found objectionable, it hits you different.
Yeah. No, it does. And it's not a complete parallel, but that's why in that chapter I wanted to talk a little bit about Liberia, for instance. You know
right.
what I mean? And just the idea. I get it. The appeal of, hey, we're going to have a state of our own. We're going to get away from these people that did, you know, X, Y, and Z for us. We will have safety there. And yet then you find yourself enacting, you know, systems that, if not are the same or similar, are at least, you know, morally deeply problematic.
Right. And having to justify them through either threat or the situation or you don't understand.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is that the story in a condensed form of all of us? Does for society to progress, does there also have to be exploitation? Do you grapple with this idea that when we think about anything, whether it's the American story or the Israeli story or any of those, it's stories of empire, whether it was the Ottoman Empire or the Caliphate, it's groups of people living under the grace of a leader who controls their lives? And can we progress outside of that? Is there another way to do this? Has there been another way to do this?
Yeah.
If we shine that light on any country that grew through, won't there be a story of exploitation and mistreatment that we find? Maybe not as horrific, right. but we find it.
Yeah, I think, though, we have to guard against the temptation to accept that history is necessarily the limit of who we are as
right.
human beings. That just because, I mean, you know, that it's been that way, that it necessarily has to be that way. I will, for instance, highlight, you know, the underlying role of nationalism and the belief that a nation state is the way to secure and safeguard a minority. That is a very recent development as a belief system, actually.
Right.
You know, that is not eternal. That's
not. But prior to that, wouldn't it have been tribalism, or wouldn't it have been something?
It would have been a king.
Collection of,
it would have been a pope. It would have been, you know, my allegiance is, you know, X, Y, and Z. But what I'm saying is, it is not innate in us to say, I am of this ethnicity. We should all have a state together. And perhaps more importantly, we should deny rights to people who are not of that ethnicity.
Right.
We don't have to be that way. We don't have to be that way.
A man from your lips to God's ears. I always wonder, you know, there was that, I can't remember the experiment, but it was they assigned a class where people with brown hair got privileges.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the people with blonde hair were like,
Right.
And they got set. And then the people with brown hair started to kind of abuse the people with blonde hair.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that thinks, boy, we could solve religious differences.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we would go back to killing each other over something else equally as arbitrary.
Yeah.
And that, I'm wondering how you get that zero-sum game element that you witnessed up front out of it. Because I'd like to believe it's not malevolence, but ignorance and fear.
I think it's a lot of fear. And frankly, I think it's a lot of anger.
Right.
I think, and obviously, for obvious reasons, you would know this better than me, but I sense that a lot of it is the humiliation of the Holocaust. I think that is, you know, very, very much present.
Right.
And not feeling like I will never be in that position again.
Sure.
You know?
Never again.
Right.
I think the thing that so many Jewish people, and not everybody, look, it's not a monolith either. Mm-hmm. Jewish religion, Jewish culture is certainly not a monolith, and there's many different opinions. I think if we start from a baseline of, I would like a safe and secure Israel and a safe and secure Palestine, and that's my starting point to any argument, and then we're just talking strategy.
Yeah.
But I think the idea of never again, you try to internalize it not just as a self-defense kind of dictum.
Right.
You hope to think of that as never again for anyone.
Right, right.
And that's the part that feels the worst.
Yeah.
When you look at it in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm curious how you feel, you know, so in Africa, you know, I'm curious about what you think about this idea of diaspora.
Yeah.
When people are in diasporas and it carries this weight of you are lost, you are not in a place where you can, you know, I don't think Italian people who live in America think of themselves as I'm in a diaspora.
Right.
They think of themselves as like, I'll take a tour maybe when I'm old, you know what I mean? But Jewish people, black people, there's this feeling of somehow we're not safe.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a dangerous thing
to think. Does it not come from being degraded and being made to feel like you are outside of the place that maybe you would like to call home? This is great.
That's interesting.
Book, The Pity of It All. And it's about Jews in Germany.
Oh, God. Are you
going
to make me read something
else?
No,
it's going to be quick. I promise to be quick about this.
I'm still just getting through Breaking Bad. I can't even.
But it's all of these, you know, Jews who are all these German Jews who want to be German. Right? Like, they really, really want to believe in Germany.
Right.
And they get the Holocaust.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that has to assault your sense of, you know, the idea that you can somehow be safe out of
it. And then how much, then, does humiliation play a part in all of it, including kind of what has been what we would consider the modern age version of exploitation and colonialism? Like, even when we think about the regions that you were that you went into were kind of a post World War One mandate that was drawn, you know, Lebanese, Syrian, Palestine mandate. The French are going to take this. The English are going to take that. I mean, it's, you know, pawns on a board that people are moving around. And does that humiliate a region to the point where if we don't address that, we can't get through it?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Right. I mean, I will say that one of the hard things about that and getting a little too psychological about this is I spent 10 days there.
Oh, so you know it all.
Exactly. Right. One of the tough things was, I have to tell you, the perspective of Palestinians and the extent to which their perspective has been pushed so far out of the frame was incredible. I felt like I was seeing a new world.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's like shameful for me to admit. I'm not bragging about that. You know, it's not because that world wasn't there. Or that world doesn't, you know, hasn't been trying to present itself. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I just wonder how many of these conversations would be improved if our media organizations made a concerted effort, whenever they talk about this topic, to ask, do we have anybody Palestinian that we've invited to be part of this at all?
Allow it on the Democratic convention floor.
I think
access to different stories has always been a difficulty for America in general because of that sort of solipsistic worldview. You know, we tend to be slightly narcissistic when it comes to the vision of it. And it's such a necessary thing. I wonder if it really improves it. I mean, here's something that I grapple with. I've known about it forever. Mm. I have friends who have Palestinian families who've suffered through it. I have friends in Israel who suffered through it. Mm. And it sometimes feels as though the only people that benefit are the powers that be. And all these good people are so left behind by this weird power structure that we left in place there.
Yeah.
And you bring up an interesting point, which is a path forward of reconciling humiliation. And I don't know, what is the mechanism of that? Is there one? And is it that sort of, you know, you think about South Africa and Truth and Reconciliation, but is there a mechanism to heal that for people? Or is it purely self-determination and that's...
You know, I don't know.
Well, that's all the time we have. I don't know.
I don't know.
But it is, I wonder, because you bring up such an interesting, it is such a powerful river of emotion.
Yeah.
And when you say, I can almost not cry talking about
it.
Because it's so deeply gets at the heart of our humanity. Yeah. Like, people just want to be seen and just want to be...
No, and it's palpable. I could feel it.
Yeah.
You know, I could really feel it. One thing I would suggest is, and we have actually had this struggle with this as African Americans, and I'll tell you this from the black perspective. There is great, not always spoken shame in the black community over the kind of physical traumas we've endured. You have to understand, man, every single one of us, every single African American is a child of sexual violence. All of us.
Right.
All of us. There is not a single pure African American who came through asleep. There is an amount of humiliation in that. There is an amount of humiliation in watching, and I've written about this, you know, films from the 60s and watching these kids and these children, you know, get beaten by the cops. There is humiliation in, you know, watching today, you know what I mean? George Floyd, you know, a knee on his neck. And I do think, you know, a significant part of it is understanding, particularly with the past, these people didn't want to be enslaved.
Right.
You know what I mean? These people didn't want to get beat. And it's not true that these people did nothing. It's not true that these people just willingly, you know, you know, went to it. There was a slogan out for a while that a lot of us shouted down, we are not our ancestors, as if to say we somehow are more, you know, resilient and resistant. You know what I mean? We're not going to be punked and chumped. Yes, we would have. If we had been them, the same thing would have happened. We're no braver, you know?
There's such an analog with that, with the Jewish community. And there is, you know, and you hear it a lot about, you know, the first thing Hitler did is he disarmed the Jews. And you're like, the Jews were not like gun-toting motherfuckers. Like, you know, if you had taken our violins, maybe that would have been something. But like, like, oh, they disarmed the Jews, and that's how Hitler was able to get the Jews to do that. And you're like, oh, you know who had guns and didn't do too well with Hitler? France.
Right.
But you're right. There's that sense of, like, how could you let your people? How could you allow that to happen?
Yeah.
And it does skew their perspectives. Yeah. And I can already see your next book. Where you fix it all. it's an amazing piece. Thank you. And the main thing is, and listen, man, like, let's not kid ourselves. Once you delve into Israel-Palestine, you're going to take a ton of shit. I don't know where it'll come from everywhere. And I hope you don't wear it personally, but you've done the most important thing.
Can I just say one quick thing?
Yes, please.
It will not measure up to the burdens of what I saw Palestinians on the West Bank bearing. It's not even
that's, that's an excellent point. The only point I was going to make is through your discomfort, albeit not the same discomfort, you've done the most important thing, which is try to advance and delve into an understanding of a complexity that we haven't figured out in 10,000 years. And so I applaud that. And your writing, as always, is so beautiful and moving. So thank you so much for being here.
Had you spoken to President Trump about that before you wrote that in the book?
Yes, he knew my position and my beliefs since the day we met. And I believe in individual freedom. I want to decide what I want to do with my body. I think I don't want government in my personal business. I think it's very important. And as I said in the book, and it's very well explained in the chapter, what does really my body, my choice means? Because timing really matters, and also the restrictions. So I encourage people to read it, because we live in the world that everybody has should have individual freedom. That was not written in the last week or the last month.
These are your convictions.
Correct, but that book was written months before, and it was in a print months before. So that was my belief, and it is my belief, and I wanted to put it in the book because I want to be authentic.
Joining us now is Texas Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, a national co-chair of the Harris-Walz campaign, one of the featured speakers, of course, at the DNC. Congresswoman, it's great to see you again. You led the campaign's fight for reproductive freedom on that bus tour. Does the Harris campaign welcome any support for abortion access wherever it comes from, even from the former First Lady?
I think that's actually been the really kind of scratch your head moment that we all are examining right now, really trying to figure out, are you guys trying to play good cop, bad cop, and trying to bring people in and to trust Donald Trump? Because obviously, when we think about a spouse, we think about pillow talk. And so it's like, well, maybe he's going to be good on this issue. But let me tell you, there's one thing that I believe that the American people are better at, and that is being tricked or fooled. This is Donald Trump's Supreme Court that literally stripped us of our rights. And so considering the fact that he is the one that set us ablaze and set us on fire, I don't then anticipate that he's going to be the fireman to actually put this fire out. So listen, we don't have to trust what they say. We have to trust what they do. And what we know is that Donald Trump has bragged about the overturning of Roe.
And Congresswoman, as a co-chair of the campaign, there's criticism from some that, you know, Vice President Harris is not doing enough interviews, that she's out there campaigning, but she's not taking part in interviews. I know she was willing to do another debate. Donald Trump refused so far. Time is running out. But she seems to falter in interviews. She did one with Stephanie Ruhl. She did one, of course, with Dana Bash. She did one with local Pittsburgh KDKA. That's three interviews in this entire campaign.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I was one of those that said, I don't care if she does an interview at all. And I'm going to be honest with you. Listen, she is running a historic campaign in a historic amount of time. And so when you're trying to figure out which one you should really take the time to do. I honestly am the type of person that believes in taking your message to the people. You know, when we consistently hear things like, well, people say that they don't know her and that kind of stuff, I think that they actually want to interact with her. And I honestly think that that is actually where she is her strongest, when she's able to actually be there with the people, feel the energy of the people, and the people be able to feel her sincerity in the policy positions that she's taking and in her message of trust me, because I will take this country forward instead of allowing it to go back. So I think that this is just a very different election. And I think that she's doing the best that she can with the minimal amount of time that she's got left to get this done.
Well, she could certainly do more interviews, local interviews, network interviews, and those all get carried on television. It's the same as a rally. It's having the same impact in terms of reaching a lot of people. That said, you're going to have surrogates. You've got, you know, Liz Cheney. President Obama is going to start campaigning. Do you think we'll see Michelle Obama?
I think that there is a good chance that we may see Michelle. Now, this isn't any information that I've been given, so I don't want anyone to perceive that you're breaking news right now. But we are a big tent party, and we've got a really big bench. And so I think that we are all hands on deck right now, and I think that's what you're seeing, is there's surrogates from the House, surrogates from the Senate, and beyond that are out there campaigning. And as you just mentioned, the former president is going to be out there. I think that we all know the force that the former...
As many Zionist leaders acknowledge privately, if not always publicly, anybody would oppose such a thing. Right? Any indigenous population would resist such a thing. And the more far-sighted and hard-headed of the Zionist leaders were already saying very clearly in the 1920s, of course the Arabs will oppose us. And there's no peaceful resolution to this in sight, and the only thing that will decide this is superior force.
That's Zachary Lockman. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Zachary Lockman on a brief history of Zionism. Zion is the name of a hill in ancient Jerusalem. The Jewish nationalist movement coined the term Zionism in the 1890s. Zionism got the big power backing it was looking for when Britain issued the Balfour Declaration on November 2, 1917. Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, stated, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." This declaration became the major legal cornerstone for Zionist claims to Palestine. Two issues complicated things. At the time, 90% of Palestine's population was Arab Muslim and Christian, and only 10% Jewish. And the British were signing away land that was not theirs. Our guest today is Zachary Lockman. He's professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at New York University. He's the author of many books, and he's contributing editor to Middle East Report. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at NYU in 2010. And now, Zachary Lockman, A Brief History of Zionism.
I think we can see Zionism as one of a whole series of different and often conflicting responses by Jews in Europe, and especially in Central and Eastern Europe, where most of the Jews lived at the time, to the situation they found themselves in the late 19th century. The great majority of Europe's Jews and of the world's Jews at that time lived in Tsarist Russia, within the Tsarist Empire, where they were discriminated against, often persecuted as Jews, and were also extremely poor in their great majority. In the process of figuring out how to respond to this situation, Zionism was one tendency that emerged. There were lots of others, and others that were much more popular at the time and for decades afterwards. For example, from the 1880s onward, after the wave of anti-Jewish pogroms that erupted in Tsarist Russia, millions of Jews picked up and left. They voted with their feet in a sense and went to other places where they hoped they could live lives that were not subject to persecution and discrimination and find economic opportunity, escape from the terrible poverty in which most Jews in the Tsarist Empire were enmeshed. And this is when we get the mass migration of Jews from Eastern Europe to the United States and to a lesser extent to Western Europe, South Africa, Argentina, and so forth. And in this sense, Jews were part of a vast wave of millions of immigrants out of Eastern and Central and Southern Europe, most of them non-Jews, escaping poverty, seeking opportunity, in some cases seeking religious or national freedom. So this was one very powerful response. A great many Jews in Eastern Europe stuck to the old ways. They continued to live deeply religious lives. They felt that whatever they endured was God's will, and as long as they lived in accordance with the laws of the